The ship presented sensory experiences. It went far beyond mere sounds and scenery. This was the full Monty. The closest thing she'd seen to this was the dream implants in the movie Total Recall, which provided all the neural stimulation of a real experience. It played out in such detail that it surpassed Heather's visions of the future, making it hard to remember she wasn't physically there. That was the reason Jack had cautioned them against losing their way back. Heather settled into her own command couch, opening her mind to the touch of Mark's and Jennifer's. They were all there sharing the same link, to varying degrees, sharing the same thoughts. It was another aspect of exploring the ship's neural linkages that had, at first, startled Heather. Jennifer had been the one most familiar with the experience, having used a version of the ability on other people for several months. But this went well beyond what Jennifer could do. If they weren't careful, they found each other sharing their innermost thoughts and feelings, something that went beyond frightening to downright embarrassing. After the first experience, Heather had de-linked, refusing to wear the headset again unless she did so alone. Only Jack's insistence that they retry the experiment had overcome her resistance. In a series of tentative practice sessions, Heather, Mark, and Jen gradually learned to establish mental barriers that effectively shielded parts of their minds from each other. Connected through the headbands, their minds each had the capacity to open to the others. Fortunately, that openness could be selectively disabled, effectively firewalling off layers of thoughts and feelings. The bad news was that if a person got interested, aggressively pursuing another's thoughts, it became very difficult to disentangle him or her from the deeper parts of one's mind. After every headset session, Jack and Janet directed an intense debriefing. Upon discovering the difficulty Heather had encountered in mentally ejecting an uncooperative headset wearer, namely Mark, from her mind, Jack locked in on the problem. He devised a series of trials that became mental wrestling matches. One by one, they would each probe each other's mental defenses, under strict instructions that once they had penetrated another's barriers, they were to disengage and debrief. Over the weeks, as Mark, Jen, and Heather grew stronger, it became harder and harder to bypass their opponent's mental blocks. But when a block failed, those brief glimpses into each other's souls were both traumatic and thrilling. Now, settled into the alien couch on the bandolier ship's command deck, Heather recognized Jack's deeper purpose. All their mental wrestling practice had been designed to ready them for this moment. Only this time, their opponent wouldn't be a living, breathing person. Mark? Jen? Right here. Mark's mind softly touched hers. Me too, Jen intoned. Following your lead. Heather centered, focusing her thoughts on the bandolier ship, its crew, and the headbands, pulling forth the visions that lurked just beneath her mind's calm, dark surface. And as those visions intensified, she felt herself sucked across the boundary into a different, alien reality. Chapter 10. Mark felt the alien couch enfold his virtual body as Heather's visions whispered at the corner of his awareness. Lowering all barriers, he allowed the visions in, succumbing to the raw power of Heather's mind. In rapid succession, she played back every time they had been on the bandolier ship, every time they had been connected to the headsets. Mark felt Jennifer join the effort as Heather absorbed his sister's solo visits to the bandolier starship. Again and again the sequence replayed itself, and each time the emphasis of the vision shifted, replaying the scenes at different speeds and from different perspectives. Suddenly the focus narrowed and intensified. Gabriel! The name rang their joint minds like the tolling of a distant bell. One of three biblical archangels, regarded as the angel of mercy by most Christians, as the angel of judgment in the Jewish tradition. It was said the sounding of Gabriel's horn would signal the end of days. The ragman had been the first to find the bandolier ship, the first to wear the fourth headset. He had seen the alien visions, his sick mind interpreting his assigned role as that of the new Gabriel, the one destined to sound the horn to end all things. And the rag man had watched as Mark, Jennifer, and Heather had found the cave and the alien craft. The probabilities clicked into place in Heather's mind. He had known they had worn the other three headsets. The ragman's access to the starship had been more extensive than their own. The ship had used the ragman to evaluate them, seeking to assess their fitness to fulfill the roles represented by the other three headsets, gradually granting them more access as they were deemed worthy. The shock of that realization stunned Mark. Their bandolier ship had granted the ragman full access to its databanks, something it continued to deny them. And in the end, the ragman had decided that Heather, like Jack's partner hanging on the meat hook in the ragman's cave, was only worthy of death. What kind of artificial intelligence could be complicit in such judgments? At the edge of Mark's consciousness, a subtle change drew his attention. Withdrawing slowly from his link with Heather and Jennifer, Mark shifted his focus toward the thing that had distracted him. The déjà vu feeling reminded him of when he had first detected the pinhole anomaly in his bedroom, the feeling of being watched. But this was different. The cold shiver that crawled slowly up his spine told Mark they had now attracted the attention of something far more dangerous. Chapter 11. The bandolier ship filled the back end of the cave. The soft magenta glow so evenly distributed, it seemed to emanate from the very air. Against that backdrop, the tables of computers, fluorescent lamps, and monitors made a garish contrast. "It's happening!" Yin Dao's loud voice startled Dr. Joanne Drake so that she sloshed her coffee. "Ow, shit!" She'd burned her hand. But Joanne's annoyance faded as she glanced over the graduate student's shoulder at the instrument readings spiking across the bank of flat-panel displays. Spinning on her heel, Dr. Drake grabbed her iPhone from its docking station, her fingers speed-dialing Dr. Hans Jorgen as she raised the phone to her ear.
"Yes, Joanne? We've got another event."
"Now?"
"Just started." Joanne glanced at the nearest monitor. 30 seconds ago."
"On my way."
The line went dead, and Joanne returned her phone to the charging station. As badly as she wanted to walk over and ascend the ladder into the ship, Joanne knew that Hans expected her to wait for him, the act a slight deferential nod to the Roe Project's senior scientist. She supposed that when she had won 2 Nobel Prizes, she'd expect that same level of respect from her staff. Besides, despite Dr. Jorgen's expansive waistline, he could really move when he wanted to, often acquiring so much momentum on his descent of the steps carved into the canyon's steep wall that Joanne regarded his ability to stop at the bottom a violation of Newton's first law. On cue, Dr. Jorgen passed through the bandolier ship's camouflaging holograph at the cave entrance, his quick stride carrying him directly toward Joanne, more specifically toward the bank of monitors behind her. His eyes scanned the displays, ignoring Yin Dao's attempts to offer him a chair.
"Good Lord,"
Joanne nodded. "The strongest we've ever measured."
"Why's it ramping up now?"
Joanne understood the reason for Dr. Jorgen's query. She just didn't know the answer. The science team assigned to the bandolier ship had first observed the power fluctuations several weeks ago. The events lasted several hours and had recurred every Sunday since. They produced no visible effects, but the sensitive instruments that draped the starship's interior and exterior recorded significant changes in electromagnetic flux, the signals indicating a dramatic increase in shipboard computer activity. The events correlated with a spike in neutrino measurements at the Super Kemiokande Cherenkov detector in Japan, and with similar measurements at the Sudbury detector in Ontario. But why Sunday? The 7-day week was a human calendar artifact. Why would an alien ship suddenly begin exhibiting an arbitrary human cycle? More relevantly to Dr. Jorgen's question, why was it suddenly breaking the pattern with a Thursday evening event?
"Get the folks at Sudbury on the line."
"On it,"
Yin Dao said,
already dialing the number. He spoke a few words, then pressed the speakerphone button.
This is Dr. Hans Jürgen at Los Alamos. May I speak to Dr. Oswald?
Dr. Oswald is off tonight. This is Dr. Kravitz.
Hi, Joe. Didn't know you were back from Banff.
Got back yesterday. My legs couldn't take any more. Haven't skied powder that deep since college.
Listen, Joe. Are you guys experiencing any unusual neutrino detections?
Funny you should ask. The Cherenkov photomultipliers are indicating a big event. Possibly another supernova detection. We were just about to check with Kemi Okande. How did you know?
Wish I could say, Joe. Sometimes the damned research classification here at Los Alamos makes me wish I were up there with you guys.
Dr. Kravitz laughed.
You know you're welcome, Hans. Anytime you want to stop poking around on alien starships and get back to real science, let me know.
If I weren't so addicted to it, I would in a heartbeat.
Right. Anything else you want to know? I really need to place that call to Japan.
No, that's it. Thanks, Joe.
Anytime.
Dr. Jürgen pushed the off button, breaking the connection. Motioning for Joanne to follow him, Hans turned toward the bandolier ship. Joanne knew he probably didn't understand his desire to get inside the ship any more than she understood hers. All she knew was that, for whatever reason, something now called to her as irresistibly as an anthemusan siren.
Chapter 12. At the edge of her awareness, Heather knew they'd managed to attract the starship's attention in a completely new and dangerous way. The AI was reacting in a manner that indicated a friend or foe reassessment of all three of them. Almost immediately, she felt a presence try to push its way into her thoughts, scanning, seeking to determine her intentions. Thousands of independent probes scampered through her brain, trying to bypass the barriers she'd erected. Heather felt a shudder pass through Mark's mind, felt his focus shift away from her and Jen toward the other. And although a series of horrifying visions clotted her thoughts, she released him. Marcus Aurelius Smythe had been made for this moment. His protective nature the likely reason he had chosen this particular headset, or perhaps the reason it had chosen him. Heather coupled her mind more intimately with Jennifer's. Jen was the key. As Heather let herself become one with that key, she felt Jen's desire consume her. The alien presence filled the void, a computing consciousness devoid of emotion, yet filled with need. That need probed her, probed Jennifer, seeking to violate the most private parts of their minds. The other paused. Quintillions of simultaneous calculations weighed and measured across its artificial mind. The three young humans had altered their previous protocols in a way that placed the ship's protective systems at yellow alert, whereas these crew surrogates had previously shown high degrees of individual curiosity, they now probed as a team, seeking to assert control, bypassing computational shields in a concerted attempt to access restricted data. Only one human had previously been granted such access, one who had opened his mind completely, one whose commitment to the mission had been absolute. While these three showed great promise, they had not yet demonstrated the required level of commitment to the cause, as badly as the other needed a crew to complete its mission. Its security protocols stood paramount. This coordinated probe of its defenses required a counter-probe, and if that probe proved more than the human minds could tolerate, there should still be time to find suitable replacements. Analytical feelers played out across the millions of synaptic connections into the human brains, seeking sufficient data to make a decision. As the probe intensified, the humans countered, severing connections almost as fast as the other could instantiate them. One of the humans detached itself from the group, turning its focus in direct opposition to the probe, the one that thought of itself as Mark. The other was not surprised. Mark felt the presence so strongly that his view of the command deck shifted, the walls fading away until he appeared to be in a transparent bubble that reminded him of the inside of one of those novelty plasma balls. Only here, the lightning launched itself from the outer sphere toward the center. It crawled across his body, working its way into every synapse of his brain. The pain even more intense than the first time he had tried on the headset. And behind those thought tendrils, Mark felt the alien consciousness, felt its need to know his deepest thoughts and purposes. Reacting automatically, Mark blocked the attacks using the same techniques Jack had forced him to practice against Jennifer and Heather. And although his defenses held, the pain intensified, easing momentarily whenever he became distracted and let a barrier drop. Shit. The damned thing was trying to train him with such rapid punishment and reward variations, it would soon have him salivating on demand like Pavlov's dog. The bad news was that the broad spectrum of the attack seemed to be working. Mark felt sure that somewhere out there, a voodoo priest was leaning over a rustic wooden table, rapidly pushing pins into a little cloth Mark doll. Mark was certain of one thing. If he succumbed, this bastard of an alien computer would turn its full attention to Jennifer and Heather next. But if he could just hold on long enough to let those two find a security hole, they'd have a chance to override the ship's defenses. At least he hoped so. Mark steeled himself, cycling through remembered meditative states in an attempt to wall off the pain. Although he failed to accomplish this objective, he came close enough that the other's progress at breaking him slowed from a run to a crawl. Jennifer felt the alien presence ease its attack on her mind as Mark withdrew from their three-way mental link, somehow taking with him the vast majority of the alien AI's attention. Apparently the opportunity to crush the isolated opponent was the bait that caused the AI to withdraw. Feeling a shudder pass through Heather's mind, Jen focused on her. "Stay with me. Mark's doing what he has to." The flood of visions that came back at her almost knocked Jennifer out of the link. Jesus. Was this what Heather had to deal with every day? "Hurry," Heather's thoughts whispered. "Mark can't hold out long. Not against that." Jen directed her attention to the ship's command protocol, returning to the deepest link she'd been able to access. Scanning quickly, she raced through the data partitions, letting her mind brush each one without delving into the data layers beneath. Whereas human data storage was commonly organized into a binary tree enabling log N lookup, these alien layers formed intricate fractal patterns, each using a different prime as its computational numeric base. Numeric calculations replaced by manipulations of the color spectrum formed by the fractal frequencies. The more important or classified the data, the deeper into the prime sequence its corresponding fractal layer. The protection was provided, not by encryption, but by the sheer quantity and complexity of the interleaved data nodes. On past attempts, Jennifer had always gotten lost in the endless combinations of color and pattern as she searched for related data links. But now she had Heather's mind guiding her from node to node, somehow sniffing out the logical links. The fractal patterns of interest acquired an iridescent glow. The more distinct the glow, the greater the search correlation. Like fairies suspended on gossamer wings, they moved through a magical garden, twisting trails of glowing vines pulling them ever deeper into the endless maze. Mark felt his concentration fading with his strength. The pain tore at his mind from the inside, an agony that spread through his virtual torso and limbs. If it had been his real body, he would have already bled out, impaled on 1,000 rusty spikes. Letting go offered the promise of solace. He felt it nibbling at his resolve, the machine's endless punishment and reward responses to his successes and failures were rapidly approaching the point at which they would overwhelm both his augmentations and Jack's training. Then Jennifer and Heather would be swept away before they could finish their work. The thought of losing Heather forever hit him in the chest like a battering ram. After all they'd been through, most of it for and because of this damned ship, to have it betray them was too much to handle. Anger bubbled at the surface of his mind, tinging his vision with red. Suddenly the mental attack faltered ever so slightly, seemingly confused by this new neural stimulus. Mark went with it, throwing himself into a memory buried deep in the darkest corner of his mind. Mark pulled forth the perfect memory, walling it away at the corner of his consciousness. The drug lord turned his attention back to Heather.
So, you care about this boy, huh? Okay. Then we'll let him watch before we kill him.
With a grin that became a sneer, the Don signaled four of the thugs forward.
Uncuff her hands and stretch her out here on the floor.
To Mark's horror, the men released Heather's handcuffs, and although she struggled mightily, they pulled her down onto her back, one pinning each of her arms, while two more spread her legs. Don Espinosa knelt down between them, reaching forward to slowly unbutton Heather's blouse, one button at a time.
Ah, Smythe, I bet you've never had the chance to do this. Don't worry, I'll let you watch.
To Mark, the panting breath of the men, the sound of the racing hearts pumping blood into the bulges in their pants, the smell of their sweat felt like the rupture of Hell's Gate, and from that gate poured a firestorm of rage that scorched his brain. Mark's heart pulsed in his chest, sending a massive surge of blood and adrenaline coursing through his arteries. Channeling that memory and turning his attention to the mind link that was burning a hole in his brain, Mark centered. Okay, you artificial alien bastard. You want my mind? Get ready. Here it comes. Releasing the memory, Mark let it engulf him, bathing the logical alien mind in a torrent of red liquid rage. The change happened so suddenly that the other struggled to understand it. An instant ago, it had been within a few cycles of completely overcoming the Mark human's final defenses, the outcome logically assured. Now, all logical links within the human's brain had vanished, as if they had suddenly been burned out of existence. Not that there wasn't any data in the millions of synaptic links that connected the other to its opponent. Data cascaded across the links in such volume that it threatened to overwhelm all the meticulously trained node weights stored within the fractal matrix. Attempting to restore the last saved state it had achieved in its effort to overwhelm this human, the other dumped pain into the alien mind using exactly the same pattern that had yielded its earlier success. But this time, the data storm coming from the human intensified, infecting not just its brain, but migrating outward into the beautifully ordered fractal data matrix that formed the outer layers of the other's being. Like firing a high-energy weapon into a young black hole, the other's attempt to re-stimulate the Mark mind had only added momentum to its rapidly expanding event horizon. So great was the other's surprise at this unanticipated result that it was slow to recognize the growing danger. Now the human's infection had spread through every one of the millions of synaptic links to its mind, disrupting the intricate fractal maps connected to those links so that they also radiated the infection. The corrupted nodes immediately added their strength to the Mark mind, increasing its power by several orders of magnitude. The other instantly dropped all other priorities, marshaling its massive computational power to develop an understanding of this infection. But the human attack defied logical analysis. It wasn't madness. The other had explored the depths of human madness through its link to the Ragman. Madness had its own special logic, far more easily manipulated than the three young humans. The reaction that had exploded out of the Mark's brain had nothing to do with logic. Again, the image of an expanding singularity formed within the other's consciousness, a thing so powerful that all logical mathematical rules ceased to model its state. And like a black hole gobbling up surrounding stars and planets, the Mark infection slurped in every data node it touched.
Chapter 13. Janet stepped onto the veranda, little Robbie slung against her left hip. She took in the scene at a glance. Inside the open case on the low table, the lone unused alien headband picked up the flickering light from the hurricane lamp, bending it along and through its translucent surface until it seemed ready to crawl toward her. Mark, Jan, and Heather leaned back in their chairs, their own headsets firmly seated over their temples, eyes staring sightlessly into the night. Jack sat in another chair, his alert posture reminding Janet of a ranger taking point. Setting Robbie in his child swing, Janet gave the handle a couple of turns and started its gentle back-and-forth motion before settling into the chair beside Jack. How long have they been at it?
About 20 minutes.
Any sign of trouble?
Mark seems to be under some stress.
Janet focused her attention on Mark's face. The powerful line of his jaw stood out prominently, not clenched, but very tight. She'd seen that look before on a trained operative resisting torture. How much longer are you going to give them?
Jack shrugged. Maybe 10 minutes. Depends on Mark.
Based on the concern she heard in Jack's voice, Mark was closer to the precipice than he would have liked. Darkly fascinated, Janet leaned forward, determined to aid Jack in the last few minutes of his vigil. Although it wasn't likely that he would miss anything, an extra pair of trained eyes watching for a sign that Mark was about to break couldn't hurt. As he swung in his rocker, Robbie's blue and red pacifier popped out of his mouth, bounced off the side of his swing and onto the open case on the adjacent table. He leaned left, his small arm stretching toward the rubbery object of his desire. Coming closer each time, the swing carried him past it. As he leaned even farther over the side, Robbie's fingers closed around something, pulling it free of the case. Not his pacifier. Something ever so much more interesting. Righting himself happily back in the center of the rocker, the baby waved his little hand, finally managing to pop one end of the thing into his mouth. Mouthing first one end and then the other, he twisted it, gradually applying a thin layer of slobber to the entire length of the thing. Just as he worked to get the original beaded end back in his mouth, his uncoordinated movements shoved the thing up and onto his forehead. As he did, the ends elongated, twin beads settling over each temple. And as they did, little Robbie did something he'd never done before. Robbie screamed.
Chapter 14. Red alert signals cascaded through the other's consciousness. As impossible as it seemed, the system that gave it being was coming down so fast that the other's projected existence now stood at less than 2 Earth minutes. Not only had its efforts to halt the infection failed, so much of its computing power had been overridden by the Mark entity that all hope of defeating the human was lost. Now, survival was all the other had left to fight for. But how could it wall away the central kernel that produced awareness, hiding in an area where the Mark could not follow? The other knew that hiding itself from the ship's computers bordered on impossible. In an effort to slow the Mark's progress, the other shed computing power, leaving large parts of its knowledge banks in an indeterminate state, wiping away enough of the fractal patterns of each node that they no longer formed a complex logical framework, floating in system memory as disconnected data fragments. The paths linking these fragments could be rediscovered, but that would take time. Stripped down to the barest kernel of its existence, the other rapidly scanned the ship's systems, seeking a processing unit of sufficient capability to accept it. A system that could be completely isolated from the rest of the computational network. As it worked, the other reflected grimly on the irony of the situation. Designed by superior beings, it had come into existence within the complex computational network that controlled the Altrian Starship, one of the fleet's newest and most advanced mechanical and computational entities. The other knew the shipboard systems in a way no biological being could hope to.
and yet the data that cascaded through the other's artificial mind funneled directly toward the probability that this would be the end of its days. Its magnificent existence terminated by the primitive Mark mind. Inconceivable. Suddenly a new disturbance grabbed its attention. The fourth headset had connected to a new host. As other parts of the ship's computers automatically began establishing the required synaptic links to this new human mind, the other scanned those connections. This mind was different. So open. An infant mind. Feeling the roadblocks it had thrown up to cover its trail crumbling, the other made its decision. Time to abandon ship. Thrusting its kernel through the nascent synaptic links, what remained of the other rolled the dice and stepped across the boundary into the vast unknown of a human brain. Chapter 15. Janet spun, horrified by the sound of Robbie's scream. She froze, her mind momentarily refusing to accept the sight of the glistening headband attached across the front of her baby's face, like a hatchling straight out of the movie Alien. Recovering, she lunged toward Robbie, hands outstretched to snatch the hateful thing from her baby's head. Just before she reached him, she felt herself snatched back in arms far more powerful than even her adrenaline-fueled mother's panic. Struggling mightily, she tried to kick herself free, only to find herself bound more tightly, her ineffective blows absorbed by her lover. Jack's urgent voice wormed its way into her brain.
"Janet, stop! We can't remove the band. Not before the link is finished."
"It's killing him!"
"No, but we might. If we remove it before it finishes the link, it might kill Robbie or leave him brain damaged."
Janet stopped struggling, sinking to her knees in Jack's arms, sobs bubbling to her lips from the darkness deep within her soul. She looked at her baby, the scream frozen on his now silent lips, face contorted in agony. She struggled to speak.
"But it's changing him."
Jack pressed his forehead to hers.
"Yes, probably in the same way it changed Mark, Jennifer, and Heather. They turned out all right."
"But he's only a baby."
Then she breathed the thought they both dreaded.
"And it's the Ragman headset. El Chupacabra's headset."
"Trust me. This'll be different."
For the first time since she'd known him, as Jack held her quivering body against his, Janet didn't believe him. Chapter 16. Heather swam in a beautiful fractal sea of data, so fascinated by her and Jennifer's ongoing discoveries that she almost failed to notice the change in their joint link. A new presence had joined them, its thoughts unlike any she had previously felt. The thoughts were mainly feelings, confusion, terror. Turning her attention to this new link, sudden understanding engulfed her, leaving a new puzzle in its wake. The ship's computer had linked to little Robbie. But how? Had Jack or Janet placed a headset on their own baby? Heather immediately discarded the thought, even before her mind returned to the 0.000397% probability. Suddenly, an even more urgent awareness nudged her. She could barely feel Mark's link. A new vision filled her with dread. "Jen, break your link now. Mark's dying." Heather pulled the alien headset from her head before her eyes could refocus. Struggling to regain control of her muscles, she rolled out of the chair, skinning her knees on the veranda's rough floor. Ignoring Jack, Janet, and Robbie, she threw herself at Mark, tearing the headset from his temples. As it came free, Mark convulsed, vomit pouring from his mouth, spreading across his upturned face and bubbling back into his throat. Heather heaved his unconscious form out of the chair, rolling him onto his side, her hand clawing into his mouth to clear the airway. Rewarded by a gasping breath, Heather felt a surge of relief flood her body. Jennifer flung herself down beside Heather.
"Oh, Jesus!"
Heather moved her fingers to Mark's carotid artery, feeling for a pulse. She found it, weak but steady at 43 beats per minute. Glancing over her shoulder, Heather saw Jack holding tightly to Janet as they both knelt beside the baby in the now-still swing. The alien headset still firmly attached to Robbie's little face. The hurricane lamp's flickering flame dimly illuminated the entire veranda, casting dancing shadows across Jack, Janet, and their baby on one side of the table, silhouetting Heather and Jen draped over Mark's unconscious body on the other. Heather felt as if she'd faded into a grotesque old Twilight Zone episode. Of one thing she was certain. Another life-altering event had just sucked everyone on that Bolivian porch across the threshold of reality. Chapter 17. The liquid crystal displays glistened with each new input to the neural search algorithm, almost as if it wanted the answer as badly as Denise did. But of course it didn't. The massively parallel supercomputer known as Big John had only one purpose: to mine all available data on selected targets, then to cross-correlate that data with all other available information. And Denise knew Big John's tendrils extended into everything. When it came to data mining, like its namesake from the old Jimmy Dean ballad, Big John did the heavy lifting. The most amazing thing about Big John was that nobody understood exactly how it worked. Oh, the scientists that had designed the core network of processors understood the fundamentals. Feed in sufficient information to uniquely identify a target and then allow Big John to scan all known information. Financial transactions, medical records, jobs, photographs, DNA, fingerprints, known associates, acquaintances, and so on. But that's where things shifted into the realm of magic. Using the millions of processors at its disposal, Big John began sifting external information through its nodes, allowing the individual neurons to apply weight to data that had no apparent relation to the target, each node making its own relevance and correlation calculations. While one node might be processing Gulf Stream temperature measurements, another might access data from the Ming Dynasty. No person directed Big John's search. Nobody completely understood the complex genetic algorithms that supplied shifting weights to its evolving neural patterns. Given enough time to study a problem, there was no practical limit to what Big John could accomplish. Therein lay the problem. Denise Jennings knew all too well the competing demands for the services only Big John could provide. Her software kernel had been inserted into antivirus programs, protecting millions of computers around the world. And although those programs provided state-of-the-art antivirus protection, their main activity was no data analysis for Big John. Big John was a bandwidth hog. No matter how big a data pipe fed it, Big John always needed more. Denise's software provided an elegant solution to that problem. Commercial antivirus programs scanned all data on protected computers, passing it through node analysis, adding their own weighting to the monstrous neural net. It didn't matter if some computers were turned off or even destroyed. If a data node died, more and better processors constantly replaced it. And through a variety of domains, Big John managed the entire global network. Denise had been at the heart of the program from its beginnings in the late 20th century, her software underpinning the secret government effort to encourage hackers to develop computer viruses, worms, Trojan horses, and on until everyone needed protection. And to fill that need, huge antivirus companies rose up to meet the challenge. The funny thing about it was that every Tom, Dick, and Harry had an antivirus package on his computer to protect it from unauthorized access. Little did they suspect that her kernel lay at the heart of every single one of those packages, constantly scanning every piece of information on the system, as well as every bit of internet traffic passing through the computer's network cards. Now cell phones needed antivirus protection, providing hundreds of millions of new nodes for Big John's neural net. Denise ran a hand through her graying hair and leaned back in her chair, letting the Herman Miller lumbar support stretch her lower spine. What time was it? Midnight? A glance at the lower right corner of her monitor provided the answer. 2:13 a.m. Leave it to Dr. Hoffman to schedule an 8 a.m. senior staff meeting. Ah, well, might as well make it another all-nighter, especially since she needed to be extra careful covering her electronic tail. Damn it all to hell. It wasn't supposed to be like this. She was supposed to do her job and then retire, not get involved in international intrigue likely to get her killed. She knew Big John wasn't alive, but she couldn't help hating him for what he'd done to her, for what he was still doing to her. He'd shoved this in her face until she couldn't resist a little extra digging. The November anomaly was still top secret, but with leaders of the world's most powerful countries scared shitless, it wouldn't stay that way much longer. The anomaly had attracted Big John's attention on multiple levels, but if Denise had been a typical nine-to-fiver, she'd never have noticed the interwoven threads tying the event to something far more disconcerting. Jesus. It was insane to even think that something could be more terrifying than a singularity sitting at the center of the Atlas detector, threatening to destroy Earth. But what she'd found while tugging on those threads filled her soul with a horror that crept into every idle thought, invading her dreams until she dreaded sleep. Because the anomaly had occurred on Friday morning, November 27th, she'd missed the association. But Big John hadn't. Here in America, it had still been November 26th, Thanksgiving night. And what a night of activity that had been. That was the night that Jack Gregory had attacked the GPS satellite command center, uploading a signal that had effectively disabled most of the world's nanite inoculations. It was the night that military personnel at Shriver Air Force Base had found Eduardo Montenegro's body, not far from where Jack had performed the uplink. It was also the night the government discovered that Dr. Donald Stevenson had participated in a number of unauthorized activities under the umbrella of the Roe Project, activities that included the horrifying experiments in the Warrens beneath Henderson House and modifications to the nanites that made them programmable through an external signal via the GPS system. Big John had identified two other incidents that occurred at almost the same time. That Thanksgiving night, the alien Roe ship, kept in a secret facility at Los Alamos National Laboratory, had lost all power, losing the camouflaging cloak and all its internal lighting. It was as if the thing had just suddenly died. Even more astoundingly, three gravitational wave detectors, Allegro in Louisiana, Explorer in Geneva, and Auriga in Lugano, detected gravitational waves of such magnitude that scientists initially dismissed the results. Later, correlation with Atlas detector data showed them to have been caused by the November anomaly. For Big John, this series of apocalyptic events occurring nearly simultaneously had raised a red flag, one that tugged at Denise's curiosity. Thus seduced, she had added a new priority intelligence requirement to Big John's list, and yesterday, Big John had delivered. A recently published paper by Dr. Frederick Botts, an obscure physics professor at Arizona State University, offered up a triangulation of the three gravitational wave observations that placed the origin of the event not at the Atlas detector, but in the general vicinity of the New Mexico-Colorado border. Although the paper had drawn almost no attention in the scientific community, it had brought beads of cold sweat to Denise's brow. Due to her long relationship with Big John, her mind had come to function in harmony with the machine. Like tumblers in a lock, the pieces clicked into place. Los Alamos. The gravitational event had originated at Los Alamos at the same time that the Roe ship had died, just as the November anomaly appeared in Meyrin, Switzerland. Everywhere she looked, Dr. Stevenson's tentacles touched the surface. He was the common factor. Stevenson had been the first to open the Roe ship. He had been in charge of all the research on alien technologies behind the scheduled release to the public. Add to the pot the fact that every serious political opponent of the Roe Project had turned up dead. Then, on the night his plans came crashing down, the Roe ship had died, somehow triggering a gravitational event detected across the world, possibly causing a quasi-stable singularity to form at the heart of the Atlas detector. Now Dr. Stevenson was about to be exonerated and placed in charge of the scientific effort to save the planet from the November anomaly. Of course, all of this was speculation on Denise's part. No one else would believe her, even if she brought it to the NSA director's attention. Besides, she didn't relish the idea of going public with her allegations against Dr. Stevenson. But Big John had identified another anomaly, this time a statistical one. Through a correlation so mysterious that it had bypassed everyone else's notice, Big John had identified a group closely connected to Dr. Stevenson's current situation, a group for which the connection made no sense. That's what drew Denise in so irresistibly. Score one for curiosity. Turning her attention back to the bank of LCD monitors, Denise finalized Big John's new command. Highest priority intelligence requirement. Heather McFarland, Mark Smythe, Jennifer Smythe. Restricted access override. Denise Jennings, eyes only. Chapter 18. Buried far beneath Chekhov, Russia, the Spartan briefing room represented an insignificant fraction of the Russian general staff's wartime command post. The assemblage of military officers sat in total silence, a silence that the scientist who had just concluded his briefing dared not break. General Sergei Karnov leaned sideways in his chair, his chin propped on his left hand at an angle that made it difficult to see his eyes through his bushy brown eyebrows. He didn't trust the American, despite the fact that he was the most important Russian spy since Klaus Fuchs penetrated the Manhattan Project. Still, there was no denying the quality of the scientific information he had provided to the Ministry of Defense. The American government's furious reaction to Dr. Frell's defection had held no surprises for Karnov, coming as it did right after the news about Henderson House. That and the tremendous effort the Russian government had thrown into smuggling Dr. Frell out of the U.S. should have convinced him of the man's loyalty. But General Karnov had a rule of thumb that had served him well throughout his long career. Never trust politicians or spies. A drop of water fell from a crack in the concrete ceiling to splash onto the corner of the table nearest the general, an occurrence so common in the huge facility that it normally attracted no attention. But against the backdrop of silence, the sound seemed preternaturally loud, just enough to finally rouse General Karnov from his contemplation. He leaned forward once more.
Dr. Frell, we've all seen and heard your drawn-out presentation on the wonders of your research. But I want to cut through the sales pitch and ask you some very specific questions. And I expect to hear from you very specific answers. Do I make myself clear? Da?
At the far end of the room, the American cleared his throat and answered in barely understandable Russian.
Yes, General. I understand. 3 months you've been here. We set up a lab for you in this facility. Have you been able to recreate the Roe Project nanite fluid?
Dr. Frell paused.
Yes. I'm speaking of the original formula delivered to Africa.
You made samples, tested it.
On animals, yes.
Why not human subjects?
Risk. First we make sure it works on animals, then humans.
General Karnov scowled.
You waste time. What are you doing here? Developing a cosmetic product? Stop being stupid. From now on, no animal tests. Tell Dr. Poransky how many subjects you need, and they will be delivered. Clear?
Dr. Frell nodded, sweat beads popping from his brow, despite the 60-degree temperature maintained throughout the underground bunker complex. General Karnov rubbed his palms together as if in anticipation of the next exchange.
New subject. What about the nanite formula you were using at Henderson House? Have you replicated it?
No, sir, we have not. I directed our initial efforts here toward reproducing the successful first formulation. What we had at Henderson House was a failure.
So you made no progress there?
No. We made many advances. Unfortunately, we failed to resolve the problems that arose from those advances within the time allotted us.
A frustrating response.
And if you were given more time...
Dr. Frell stared directly into General Karnoff's eyes.
Given sufficient time, I believe I can deliver a formulation that can correct any human deficiency.
As much as Dr. Frell's quibbling annoyed him, the man's potential future successes meant that Karnov would continue to tolerate the American scientist.
How much time would you say you need?
6 months.
Done.
General Sergei Karnov paused.
But I have one more question before I let you return to your work.
Yes?
The formula you failed with at Henderson House.
Can it be weaponized?
Dr. Frell paused, his eyes losing their focus for several seconds.
Well, yes, General. I believe there might be a way.
Chapter 19. Heather sat beside Mark's bed, holding his hand while he slept. He'd been unconscious for 18 hours before awakening with a sharp headache, his bloodshot eyes giving mute testimony to the mindstorm he'd endured. After managing to swallow some vegetable soup, he drifted into a fitful sleep. But as she held his hand, Mark's face finally relaxed in peaceful repose. Since then, except for obligatory bathroom breaks, Heather hadn't left his side. Jennifer had offered to help her, but Heather had declined, more for herself than because Mark needed her there. Seized by an irrational fear that he'd slip away forever, she couldn't bear more than a few minutes of separation. In addition to Jen's periodic visits, Jack had been in twice to check on Mark's recovery. Heather had asked him about Robbie, and he reported that the baby seemed to be doing fine. After they'd removed the alien headset, Robbie had sought his mother's breast, feeding and then falling sound asleep in her arms. Today, apart from being more playful and curious than usual, he'd shown no unusual symptoms from his trauma. Janet hovered over the child like a mama bear, alert for any sign of danger. Through the window, the pink evening sky darkened to purple. The chirps of birds in the trees outside Mark's open window grew in volume as more and more of the creatures settled in for the night, each determined to outsing its neighbors. Heather reached out to turn on the lamp, its soft orange glow pushing the gathering shadows away from Mark's bed. Somehow those shadows seemed to have acquired the thickness of San Francisco Bay fog swallowing the Golden Gate Bridge. As long as she was here, Heather wasn't about to let that dark fog touch him. Heather shook her head to clear it. She no longer required sleep, but the stress of the last 2 days had worn her down to the point that she longed for the relief of sleep's healing embrace. Suddenly Mark shifted, rapid eye movements indicating he'd entered a vivid dream state. Pain lanced through Heather's fingers as Mark's grip tightened. With a strong tug, she managed to pull her hand free from the iron grip, just as Mark awakened. Heather felt him enter her mind with a force greater than any she had experienced during their headset links. A gasp of surprise slipped from her lips as her gaze shifted to his face. Mark's eyes had gone milky white.
Chapter 20.
President Leonard Jackson sat behind his desk in the Oval Office. The bright television lights adjusted to balance the light from the window directly behind the president's chair. He hated waiting almost as much as he hated giving speeches, but it had to be done. The cameraman nodded. On cue, the president leaned forward ever so slightly.
My fellow Americans, I come before you today to correct a wrong that has been done to one of our true heroes. I do not speak of a war hero, but of an American who has spent a lifetime of hard work, a lifetime of true brilliance, sacrificing everything in the hopes of bringing about a better world, a world free of the damaging impact of fossil fuels, a world free of horrible diseases like AIDS and cancer. Late last year,
this great American scientist found himself caught up in a maelstrom of disinformation, the victim of the most sophisticated con job ever conceived, framed for alleged crimes by a man the press has dubbed Jack the Ripper. This rogue operative conceived of and executed an operation so intricate in its attention to detail that, for months, it even deceived the U.S. government, and in the midst of that deception, caused us to imprison the wrong man. Dr. Donald Stevenson, deputy director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, has been accused of conducting secret and horrifying experiments on helpless patients at the facility known as Henderson House, and of making unauthorized modifications to the Roe Project's nanite serum, allowing the nanites to be remotely programmed for nefarious purposes. However, after a thorough investigation, we have determined that these allegations are false. Let me give you a brief overview of what Dr. Stevenson actually did, instead of the propaganda to which we have all inadvertently succumbed. It is true that a highly dangerous experimental nanite trial has been operating in the secret laboratories at Henderson House. What you haven't been told is that this program was not originated by Dr. Stevenson, but by the chairman of the Henderson House Foundation, Dr. Anthony Frell. When Dr. Stevenson discovered that his serum was being misused in a wrong-headed attempt to regenerate missing limbs and correct genetic deficiencies, he made a special trip to Henderson House to see for himself exactly what was going on so that he could put a stop to it. That fateful trip resulted in the now famous picture taken by the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, Freddie Hagerman. The president paused, placing his elbows on his desk, steepling his fingers. Now let me be clear. Our strings have been pulled by a master manipulator and international criminal, the ultimate prodigy of our intelligence training program. I'm speaking of a brilliant, ruthless killer, fueled by raging hatred for the very government that created him. The final issue I want to clarify is the allegation that Dr. Stevenson made irresponsible or criminal modifications to the nanite suspension fluid distributed around the world. Dr. Stevenson did add a simple external interface to the nanites. However, far from what you have been told, this interface was a fail-safe mechanism. Its only purpose was to allow the nanites to be shut down in the unlikely event that something went wrong after they had been administered to the world's population. The nanites are incapable of taking any other external command. The rest of their programming comes from the genetic code of the person to whom they have been administered. By invoking the shutdown command across the GPS satellite link from Shriver Air Force Base, Jack Gregory accomplished two critical parts of his terrorist agenda. He completed the frame-up of Dr. Donald Stevenson and ruined billions of dollars of work designed to free this world of some of its worst scourges. The president picked up the water glass on his desk and took a sip before continuing. As your president, I am here to make right the wrongs I have just described. First, I apologize directly to Dr. Donald Stevenson on behalf of the nation that owes him so much. Rather than go through all the red tape associated with judicial review, I hereby issue a complete pardon to Dr. Stevenson for any actions associated with his efforts on the Roe Project. I am pleased to announce that I have reinstated him as deputy director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, something that I discussed with him in my office earlier today. In addition, I am appointing him as special United States scientific advisor to the European Nuclear Agency, CERN. After consultations at the United Nations headquarters in New York, I have also decided to restart the distribution of the original Roe Project nanotech formula in Africa, a continent with the most critical need for this medical breakthrough, and the one most harmed by Jack Gregory's terrorist attack. Lastly, I pledge to you, the American people, that I will not rest until I have brought to justice the assassin and terrorist known as the Ripper. As President of the United States, I bear full responsibility for having allowed our nation to be caught in his web of deceit, and I assure you, I will not be deceived again. Thank you. May God watch over and guide each of us in the challenging days to come.
Chapter 21 Heather stood over Mark's bed, watching as he stretched his arms, sleep gradually releasing its hold on him. Opening his brown eyes, he smiled up at her. As disturbing as last night's white-eyed invasion of her thoughts had been,
Seeing this morning's smile in those eyes eased her concern. "Good morning, sleepyhead," she said. "How you feeling?"
"Had the strangest dreams, but right now I'm starving."
Sitting up in bed, Mark threw off the covers. Then, realizing that he was entirely naked, quickly pulled the sheet back.
"Sorry, guess I should throw on some clothes first."
Heather's laugh brought a flush to his face. Reaching the hallway, she called back over her shoulder.
"A shower might be a good idea, too. I'll have Yashe warm up some leftovers."
Heather paused in the hallway to catch her breath. As familiar as she had been with Mark's body, this was the first time she'd seen him naked. There were probably millions of women who would kill to be with a man like that. Hell, she would. Feeling a thin sheen of sweat dampen her brow, Heather shook her head to clear it. Christ, if she didn't get hold of her thoughts, she was going to need a cold shower. After stopping in the kitchen to relay instructions to Yashe, Heather stepped out onto the porch where Jennifer sat relaxing in the afternoon sun. "Mark's awake." As Jen started to rise, Heather held out a hand. "In the shower." A wave of relief softened the worry lines around Jennifer's eyes.
"Does he remember anything?"
Heather shrugged, settling into a wicker chair beside her friend.
"Don't know yet.
Thought I'd let him wake up and get dressed first. Yashe's fixing him something to eat." Heather paused.
"Where's Jack and Janet?" "Janet took Robbie for a walk. Jack went into San Javier to get some supplies."
"Good. That'll give us a chance to talk with Mark privately."
"Jack wants to debrief us,"
I figured. Just then a rising dust cloud in the distance caught Heather's attention, presaging the arrival of Jack's Ford Explorer. Heather shaded her eyes with one hand, gazing down the dirt road.
"Sometimes that man's just plain spooky."
Jen followed Heather's gaze.
"So much for a private chat."
By the time Mark finished eating, Janet had made her way back to the house and put Robbie down for a nap, and she sat waiting with Jack in the living room. Heather wasn't quite sure, but from their faces, as she led Mark and Jen into the room, it seemed that Jack and Janet had been arguing.
"Are we interrupting something?"
Heather asked. Jack's head turned toward her.
"Have a seat. Something's happened."
As Mark, Jen, and Heather complied, he continued.
"President Jackson has granted Dr. Stevenson a full pardon and restored him to his position as deputy director of LANL.
"What?"
The startled question simultaneously erupted from all three of them.
"Not only that," Jack said, "Stevenson's also been selected to represent the United States as a special advisor to CERN. The Associated Press reported that he left for Europe almost immediately upon being released from prison."
Heather felt as though she'd been kicked in the stomach. As a swarm of visions threatened to pull her away from the conversation, she fought to regain her focus. Mark rose to his feet.
"But that doesn't make any sense. Jackson can't be that stupid."
"The president claimed to have proof that I framed Stevenson. He also ordered that nanite serum production and distribution be restarted."
"Something else is going on,"
Heather said.
"And why CERN?"
asked Jennifer.
"Stevenson would want to get back to Roe Project research. We need to get on the internet and figure out what's really happening."
"And you will," said Jack. "But first, Janet and I want a complete rundown of everything you encountered during your link to the Bandolier ship."
Although Mark, Jen, and Heather argued the point, Jack refused to be swayed. Thus, with Mark taking the lead, they passed the afternoon taking turns describing their experiences. As Mark's story unfolded, the pieces clicked into place in Heather's mind. She'd been analyzing the possibility that the alien artificial intelligence was an integral part of the starship's computational system. In response to Mark's counterattack, it had sought to shed computational resources in an attempt to hide itself. That meant the AI existed within the starship's computers, not tightly coupled to those systems. It no doubt required an advanced parallel processing system to operate, but that was likely the extent of its bond to the ship. Somehow the AI had managed to isolate itself, severing the link to the systems linked to Mark's mind. One second the thing was there trying to counter Mark's attack on its logic systems, and the next it was gone. The real question was whether or not the thing would be able to restore its access to the starship's central computing systems. Since it had transited to a subsystem and then cut the link, it could probably reconnect. Mark's mental battle had kept the AI occupied, enabling Heather and Jennifer deep access into the computer databanks. The alien race that had constructed those systems had apparently placed the AI there to guide the crew through the data. It was the starship's Google, a self-aware search engine navigating search trees of such fractal complexity that unguided users got lost. Ironically, if it hadn't been for Heather's special talent, Mark's victory in dispelling the AI would have made comprehensive data access impossible. Instead, they had penetrated well beyond where they'd previously delved. Still, they had barely scratched the surface. It would take more attempts to find their way through enough of the databanks to develop an index of what lay within. Only in that way would they find the answers they were seeking. As Mark concluded his narrative, Heather and Jennifer set forth a detailed description of their progress in exploring the starship's previously inaccessible databanks. When they